Matthew 24, starting with verse 29. I'll be reading verses 29 through 35. It's the coming of the Son of Man, and the Son of Man is a term used for Jesus himself, Jesus the Christ. Immediately after the suffering of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the heavens, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branches become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly, I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. This is the word of the Lord. As we greet the season of Advent today, let me ask you a pertinent question. What do you think about when you think about Advent? What do you think of when you think of Advent? Well, rather than putting anybody on the spot, let me hazard a few guesses at your responses. First, you might be thinking that Advent is that season where we prepare for the incarnation, God coming to the earth in the form of a human being, Jesus. We prepare for the nativity in Advent. Or you might be thinking that Advent is a time when we reflect on our relationship with Emmanuel, God with us, that word that has become flesh. We reflect on how close we are to following the discipleship call of Jesus. Or you might be thinking, good grief, only 27 more shopping days till Christmas. Any or all of those are possible thoughts that might be going through your head, and they're all spot on. But what I'm pretty sure you're not thinking about in Advent is the second coming of Christ. Yet that's what Matthew is talking about in today's text, the second coming. He writes ominously about the sun and the moon going dark and the stars falling from the heavens. He's quoting the prophet Isaiah when he says that. And those early first century readers would know that Matthew is speaking in code here. He's not really talking about the sun and the moon and the stars. What he is saying is that there will be huge social, political, and economic convulsions signaling Christ's return. He was really referring to the overthrow of the Roman Empire. Matthew intends us to understand that the time of the return of Jesus will be a time when the world is in turmoil. Well, when hasn't the world been in turmoil? Empires and kingdoms rise and fall all the time. In my lifetime, the 60s were the time of greatest change. Many felt sure that that was when everything was going to hell in a handbasket. Or we could argue that these current days are times of even greater political, economic, and social upheaval. Shall we expect Christ's return any day now because of that? Now, the point is not predicting when Christ will come again. For who in the world would know when Christ is coming back but God himself? The point is that we should always be on our toes, ready, should that day come. Well, I know, the second coming is a tough sale in this season of twinkling lights and here comes Santa Claus. But Matthew obviously thought it important back then for those early disciples to prepare for Christ's return. His gospel, of course, begins with the nativity, and up until chapter 24 here, he talks about Jesus' ministry before he begins stories about the passion of Christ. Matthew's emphasis is pointing beyond Jesus' birth and nativity and his ministry to his second coming. As he writes in verse 33, when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates. City gates back then were key places in the daily lives of those ancient citizens. Not only were gates a mechanism for protection from potential invaders, they were the central locations for social activity. Business was transacted at the city gates. Courts convened at the gates. And important public announcements were made there. The gatekeepers would close those big doors of the gate before sunset and reopen them at sunrise, signaling that a new day had begun. Christians have long held that sunrise in the east symbolizes both Christ's resurrection at dawn on Easter morning, and that the east is also the direction of the second coming. Many churches, in fact, have their altars at the eastern end of the sanctuary to underscore this symbolism of Jesus' resurrection and his coming again in the east. Although I just learned this morning that we face west instead of east here. It makes sense then that Matthew tells us Jesus will come again, entering through the gates with trumpeting angels heralding a dawn of a new age. It will be the ultimate culmination of God's reign on earth. Jesus taught that his life was the fulfillment of God's promises, yet God's kingdom had not fully arrived. Through his ministry, the blessings of God were experienced in a new immediacy, but death, suffering, and the ambiguities of life remained for his followers. We know the same is true for us, don't we? The peace and perfection that we yearn for still feels a long way off, despite our many blessings that we receive from our faith. Despite the mercy and the grace that we experience, we know that things could be so much better, especially for the lost, the lonely, and the lowest within our society. The complete realization of the kingdom, therefore, must be in the future. That's why Jesus taught his disciples to pray, "Your kingdom come." And that's why we recite in the Apostles' Creed, "He will come again to judge the quick and the dead." Those ancient words summarize our hope that God will complete his purpose in the world in a final triumphant return of Christ. Perhaps you know folks who focus on the second coming, even trying to predict its arrival date. But for me, as I said, that's not what's important here. What's important is how we live in anticipation of Christ's return. Will we be alert to our discipleship, or will we be slothful in our devotion to his way? During Advent, the scriptures urge us to be alert and alive to our faith. There are several African-American spirituals with the lyrics, "I want to be ready, ready for when Jesus comes again, or ready when he calls my name at that second coming." So what does that look like, though, for us today, for us to be ready? Well, what would it mean for our daily living, the choices we make, the lens through which we see the world, if we, for an instance, consider that fig tree that Matthew also talks about? The fig tree gets what it's supposed to do. As the day is warm and summer arrives, the tree knows how to unfurl its new, tender leaves. Are we as comprehending as a fig tree? Do we, in fact, get that Jesus is as near as the gates through which we pass daily? Gates like our front door, the city limits of Bowie, the security systems at our schools, the airports, or in our offices. Do we know, like the fig tree, how we're supposed to be living and bearing fruit? One way we can prepare and be ready is by considering gates. Are we about erecting barriers to keep those we consider insiders safe and those we consider outsiders at bay? Or do we want everyone inside in safety? There are many of these kinds of exclusionary gates, redlined communities, HOA covenants, glass ceilings, voter suppression laws, and immigration quotas are just a few of the ways to maintain one group's supremacy over another group, to keep those considered less worthy out. That's why it's so crucial that we remember that Jesus' birth gets announced by angels as good news for all people, not just some people or a few people. And we need to believe that God did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world, all the world, might be saved through him. As we get ready to welcome the infant born to Mary in a stable, God with us, we are also called to remember to be on the lookout for that returning victorious Christ who judges all. Now, that awareness of the judgment shouldn't make us fearful, but it certainly ought to cause us to pause at every gate we approach and ask ourselves what it would mean to meet the risen Christ right there, where he is waiting. An Advent audit, in effect, is needed of our discipleship with him. So as we set up more decorations here in the sanctuary, and we see decorations going up in storefronts, we might consider them to be fig tree-like reminders, to be on the watch for the returning of the one who said we will be judged on how we treat the hungry, the prisoner, the poor, the most vulnerable among us, those we often ignore at every gate, very gates where Christ is now present. Back in 2005, in an unusually spontaneous adventure, our daughter Ruth and I went back to New York to see the Gates. In case you don't remember, the Gates was a site-specific work by artists Christo and Jean-Claude. Their installation was highly controversial. Not in my backyard, or NIMBY folks were up in arms about their possible construction. Naysayers felt that the installation would deface the park or their neighborhood, and that would it bring in too many unwanted or unruly visitors to the area. Convincing these neighbors and the proper authorities took over 14 years, but the artist eventually prevailed. When the gates debuted, it was a spectacle the likes of which New York City had never seen. Each gate was 16 feet tall, giving the project a feeling of a major infrastructure. And painted in Public Works Department orange, the gates were civic in nature. There were 7,503 of these gates along 23 miles of Central Park. From each gate hung a curtain-like panel of deep saffron-colored nylon fabric. The fabric was high enough overhead so that passing under or through was not difficult. In other words, the passageways were open and totally accessible to the millions of people from all walks of life who walked, skated, or ran under and through them. I remember walking the path and feeling how joyous it was. Everyone on the path seemed delighted with the festive display, and everyone seemed in good spirits. The bright colored curtains against the gray winter sky and the barren tree branches was uplifting. Every nationality under the sun mingled on that winding route, and it truly felt that we were all happy together. It was a glimpse of what heaven must be like when we're all united in peace, joy, and beauty. After 2 weeks passed, the project concluded, and all that previous rancor over the gates debate looked downright silly. Indeed, the craziest thing about the whole gates project was the idea that anyone would ever have resisted it. That might be the lasting value of Christo and Jean-Claude's project. Those artists exposed the folly of hysterical fear among neighbors. They demonstrated beautifully how humans can live well together. It's a vision of what Christ's second coming would be like, what his second coming would bring, when children and their parents aren't afraid of sending them to school, are fearful of shopping at the mall or Walmart, are scared off of going to the movies or a club at night. I want to be ready for that day when Christ will come again and the world's barriers and the world's turmoil will cease, when everyone will live together as beloved children of God. And until that day comes, may all our gates not be barriers, and may all of our hearts be places of welcome and hospitality. This Advent, let us prepare not just for the first coming of Jesus Christ, but also for his second. May it be so for you and for me.